Dr. Robert T. Newman, Dr. Perry Phillips, Dr. John Bloom, and your questions, total 14 at this point. The common question to those that have similarities, I've simply lumped together, and I've tried to choose a question from a variety of people so that all of you have some response. The first two questions I'll address first to Dr. Bloom, and then anyone else who might care to respond is welcome to do so. They both concern the evolution history of the horse. The question reads like this. In the evolution series of the horse, the feet and the teeth are shown at the Smithsonian Institute. Would you comment about the teeth?
Fortunately, I happen to have been there and have seen that exhibit, so I have some feel for what is being mentioned. But basically, in the development of the horse, you start with a small, general-purpose animal, is what Simpson calls it, that has a padded foot, several toes in a padded foot, and has a tooth structure, and I'm going to be a little shaky on this, whether it's browsing or grazing that it started with. I believe it starts as a browsing animal. And over the course of time, what has apparently happened is that the animal's environment changes to where a slightly different foot structure is more advantageous for it to run better. And the diet changes because it moves from a forest environment to a pasture meadow environment, so that your teeth structure changes as well to compensate for the different foods that it's eating. So basically those changes would be due to diet and due to environmental shifts. And that's how the Smithsonian explains them, if you listen to the tape that's going along with the series of classes that they show along the way. So I'm basically just repeating what they would say for why you see these changes. I don't have any great problem with that, that an animal would shift its environment. That's what Darwin is seeing with his set of finches, that the finches are picking various environments. And your beak size and coloration changes in a similar way. That I would call microevolutionary change. We're not developing new organs. We're seeing organs modify due to stresses from the environment.
Do you know anything about a, quote, modern horse, equus, and its fossil being found in the same strata as Eohippus fossils?
No, I haven't heard anything about that.
I have heard. I don't know what it's worth. Of occasional horses showing up with a multi-toed situation rather than just a single foot on occasions. We will suggest that there must be some genetic equipment around to do that occasionally.
Yeah, or it's a throwback. It'd be called a throwback. The horse basically rocks on its one fingernail, and it's most of what we see as a foot is the one finger, and the two other fingers are just very tiny bones way up in the back of the leg. And occasionally you'll get a mutation where those bones are larger and actually protrude out the back, more like the earlier ancestor for the horse head.
The third question relates to giving a precise definition of macroevolution and then explain how this relates to the absence of complex life forms in the Precambrian and the Cambrian. And I'll put that to Dr. Newman.
Well, I'm not sure this is my field, but I'll avoid throwing it back to John until I made a stab at it. Macroevolution is basically evolution on levels above the species, and particularly up in the very higher, I'll botch up the title, but classes, orders, etc. I'm not a biologist in that direction. Not thinking so much of the question of whether they learn jump or not, but just the question of the origin of these higher orders. And situation there is basically, as John suggests, that we really do not have good evidence of transitions between these higher orders. Raises a serious question there. Let me hear the wording about the Precambrian-Cambrian thing again.
How does the definition of macroevolution relate to the absence of complex life forms in the Precambrian and Cambrian?
There's certainly no complex life forms in the Precambrian. There apparently is some life back there, and Perry discusses that some. Was that in the talk this week? It might have been the talk on this.
Yeah,
the chemical evidence.
Right, the chemical evidence.
Yeah.
Find simple cells.
There's certainly some evidence of simple cells and that sort of thing in the Cambrian. but you had the pre-Cambrian, but you have this what's called the Cambrian explosion, is that suddenly, and we're talking suddenly geologically, we don't know whether it's suddenly you're standing there, but suddenly you begin to see a wide diversity of relatively complicated animals, not one-celled stuff, but multi-celled stuff, I think precursors to crabs and stuff of that sort, as my memory goes, as I'm not a biologist. I think it's fair to say that the fossil record suggests that at one point there wasn't any life. At another point, you begin to have life, but it's only simple kinds, and then you begin to have life that's more complicated, etc. And many geologists, I think, and biologists would take this and say, well, that's obviously evidence of evolution. But since the things seem to show up without good transitions, my suggestion would be God has created the lower forms. They do things to the environment that make it possible for the higher forms to operate, and then the higher forms come on, and they do some things to the environment to make it possible for higher forms, that you have God's interventions in sequences to come in. That's what I would see going on, not only the Precambrian, not only the Cambrian explosion, but on further as well.
The interesting thing is, you can break up the description of life into various categories. We talk about species, we talk about genus, you talk about family class, etc. And high up, you have what's known as the phylum level, which is just below kingdom. And the interesting thing is that in the Cambrian period, which is a geologic period that begins 600 million years ago, roughly, you find that there were 100 phyla of organisms at that particular time, which covers all the phyla that are existent today. There have been no new phyla since that time. That is, this broad category, no new phyla since that time. They occur right after the Precambrian, in the junction between the Precambrian and the Cambrian 600 million years ago. Interesting thing is that today you only have about 30 phyla of living systems around. You have fewer phyla today than what you had back then. Now, an interesting thing to contemplate is, what does it mean that God created various kinds? At what taxonomic level do you put kinds? Perhaps what we have here at the division between the Precambrian and the Cambrian juncture in geologic history is a great intervention by God where various kinds are created. We should mention at this point that when you look at the word kind in Scripture, generally, it is interpreted as meaning species. You can show, however, biblically, that kind is a very broad category. I don't know of any case that it refers to species, but it can be shown to refer to genus, family, classes, and even phyla. It's a very, very broad category. And so it's just interesting to me to see that Cambrian explosion, you have an explosion of this category of phyla that has remained fairly constant or decreased since that particular time. Maybe here's an intervention where God is creating the kinds.
That discussion, the range of the biblical meaning of the word kind, is found in Bob Dunsweiler's paper there that you should have gotten if you got the closed packet, the proposed creationist alternative. He has a discussion there of the range of meaning of the word kind, looking at the examples in Scripture.
Further questions on microevolution. One is to differentiate between microevolution and adaptive radiation.
I would say that those are two different terms for about the same thing. Adaptive radiation is where you have one basic, the finch is a nice example, where you have one basic animal and then it divides, it seems to branch out into various different types of finch depending on the environmental pressure on it. And this type of radiation that's adapting to the different environments is what they refer to as adaptive radiation. And that I would say is a form of microevolution, just one of the varieties. If you have not so much branching, but the mainstream of the genetic stuff of the animal just goes along one path, that would be a simple microevolution. This is more of a complex form of microevolution. They're about the same.
Continuing that theme, Dr. Bloom, explain microevolution as it occurs in the genome. Is it different gene expressions or mutations that cause change in the phenotype?
I think that's kind of contested. In the classic Darwin situation, you would call it actual changes in the genetic information in the animal through mutation. are, and then it's immediately being expressed, and that's what you would see. Some people, though, would propose that there's what they would call a silent gene. Where in the DNA of the molecule, there's some of the animal, there's some portions of it that are being expressed, and other portions of it that aren't. And something might happen that turns on this part of the DNA that's been silent in the past, and then you would see a sudden change in the animal. So your microevolution could be using both mechanisms. Here's a piece of DNA that's always being expressed, and there's a mutation there that changes this protein that's already been expressed and makes it. Or you might have some silent part of the DNA that decides to turn on for some reason, and that begins to be expressed, and that shows up as a change in the animal as well. So I think both mechanisms can be valid for explaining microevolution. And you'd actually have to study what is causing the change in the animal to differentiate between the mechanisms.
Could you have enough things turned on to give you macroevolution?
In the Gould school of punctuated equilibrium, I guess that would be what they would be saying. Is that in the background of the animal, there's a whole pile of the stuff that's not being expressed, and yet it's developing and changing over time. Finally, when it gets ready in the background, it suddenly bursts on stage as a major change. The problem with this silent gene problem is that if it's not being expressed, then you have a problem with Darwin, because you can't select a change in this thing as being either good or bad. It's like a book no one's reading. If there's typos in it that are in there, no one is there to judge the quality of the typos in the book. So you have this silent gene. It's never being read, yet it's changing, but there's no selective pressure on that silent information. So that's the major problem, to be evoking this as a major reason for macroevolution or something like that. You have no selective pressure on that information.
Yeah, you'd expect that sort of information to gradually become gibberish as random changes took place in it, since you don't have anything testing to make sure it works.
That's right. It would downhill rather than downhill.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah. Probably we could summarize this issue then by making some kind of a summary statement that would distinguish between microevolution and macroevolution. Is there a generally accepted boundary?
I've not run across a formal definition of a boundary. I think that what you run into is a mechanistic boundary. Microevolution is where you can see Darwin's basic things in action. Macroevolution is where you don't have that mechanism verified for what's going on. And yet they would say that something evolutionary has taken place. One sort of scheme I use to differentiate micro and macroevolution, I mentioned it there at the course, is are new organs being developed or appearing in the animal, or some major structural change, for example, the wing in a bird of the bat. Here you've got the standard forearm of bats, very similar to a mouse in some ways. The forearm, suddenly these fingers elongate tremendously, the skin fills the void between the fingers, and the thing can fly. That change in that basic organ is very drastic. It's hard to envision, again, how that could happen over small steps over time. That kind of major change in an organ I would call macroevolution, or a new organ developing from scratch, gills, amphibian lungs, that kind of thing.
Another possible definition there might be George Gaylord Simpson's, the one you showed in that chart, where he tries to distinguish between what you might call accidental deficiencies in the record and systematic deficiencies in the record, which is a distinction he makes himself, where there's evidence that this thing was here because he has a few spots along here with the gaps between them. But then here, moving up to a new whole system, he just got these dashed lines up, and he says they're systematic deficiencies. Well, that may suggest something systematically different is happening there. The punctuated equilibrium guys would say that's where the big change takes place. Your neo-Darwinians would say, that's where the little population in isolation quickly changes. And we'd say, that's where God intervened to do something or another, whether he changed the genes inside something or whether he created new something out of scratch.
In the back of the notebook and in the monographs and research reports, there are many bibliographic references cited. But would you care to highlight or recommend any non-technical publications on the origin of man that is consistent with the views held by Ibri, suitable for the non-technical Christian to read, pamphlets which might be given away, books that are more interesting for or write a book, something along that line. You might even like to highlight one or two sources that
From a general standpoint, I kind of like Weister's Genesis connection. He has a couple of his figures without any credit, but I think his discussion there is fairly good. Teaching Science in the Climate of Controversy has a section on the origin of man as well. That's reasonably good. Those are things that are already in print that are out there.
I don't think we have the Teaching Science in a Climate of Controversy in our bibliography anywhere, do we? Do you all have it from yours anywhere?
No.
That would be ordered from American Scientific Affiliation, something like Box F, Ipswich, Massachusetts. Weister is listed in several of our bibliographies, so you'll be able to spot that all right. Unfortunately, it's out of print. So what do you do there? Well, you write John Weister, I guess, and ask him if you've got any more. Or
the publisher in demand of
it. Yeah, I asked the publisher to reprint. It would always be nice whether they'll listen to you or not. I don't know. Very good.
Well, those are the books I would recommend as well. We're talking about human evolution here.
Yeah.
Or demand. Those are the books I would recommend.
Is science still up to date enough to that same
thing? It doesn't discuss origin of man. It does a little something about the order of events in Genesis in chapter 1. I'd kind of like to revise it, but the publisher let it go out of print. And until I can get him to agree to reprint it again, since by revising it, I guess. So we'll have to see where that particular thing goes. This book on page 3 of my outline for Relating Bible and Science by Paddle Hunn, Evolution, Nature, and Scripture in Conflict, does not fit the category, I think, that somebody asked there for something on a nice popular level, but does have a good discussion of the biological matter relating to evolution, and does have a pretty good discussion of the questions regarding human evolution, as I recall. I just read it recently. Unfortunately, it's out of print, so it's 82 book. A part of the complication is because of overhead costs, and a rather high rate of interest these days, very few publishers keep anything in print unless it's moving rather rapidly. So if something is selling only a few hundred or 1,000 or so a year, and it depends on the publisher, when their stock runs out, they won't bother to reprint because they're afraid that if they reprint it, they'll just pick up where it left off at that low rate and keep going. This book by Alan Hayward, also on page 3 of mine, Creation and Evolution, the Facts and the Fallacies, I think is rather good. That does not appear to be available in this country anymore, but maybe it's still available in England. It's published by Triangle Books in London.
Thank you. A question with a twist, a different orientation. Do any autographs of any portion of the Bible exist?
Well, I don't know whether they exist or not. None of them are extant. Okay, in textual circles, the term extant means exists and is known by the scholarly community at large to exist, the answer to that would be no. Okay. It would be of some interest, however, to point out that no public documents, no published writings from antiquity exist in the autographs, to our knowledge. Okay. That is, any work that we know about from antiquity, we got lots of, and such, none of those have survived in the autographs. The only thing we got autographs of from antiquity are inscriptions, one copy made, and somebody chiseled it in stone, still there, and a number of private letters and such sorts of things, which were written probably in one copy, the original and maybe one copy that the guy kept. And of course, there were millions and millions and millions of those written in antiquity, and some of them were thrown in trash piles in such places that they survived to modern times. So, that would be it as far as I know. There may be some examples of official letters where there are a few copies made, a proclamation of which are a few copies, but even there, I doubt if we've got any autographs on them.
The problem here is survival. The things that survive are things like clay tablets, upon which writing was made, so you see some of those things surviving. But I suspect you're talking about autographs of the scripture here, and the answer is no. You have very old copies, but you do not have any autographs of the scriptural material.
I'll address that question to Dr. Phillips. Did the Apollo landing show any signs of, quote, microscopic meteors?
There's a good bit of evidence of microscopic meteors on the moon. Basically, when an object hits the surface of the moon, regardless of how large or how small it is, it causes a tiny explosion that is equal to about the same amount of TNT going off. You have to realize some of these objects that hit the moon are going literally tens of thousands of miles an hour. And when they hit, they explode. Since there's no atmosphere to slow it down, whether you're talking about a big object or a small object, when it hits the surface, it's going to explode. If it's tiny, tiny explosion. If it's large, big explosion. When you look at the moon, you see the craters. What you're seeing is the evidence of large objects that have hit the moon and exploded. If you go into a smaller scale and pick up a small rock and look at it, you see craters of small objects that have hit the rock. And then if you look even on a smaller scale, you still see craters. Basically, the moon looks the way it does as a whole. It looks the same way as you get closer and closer to the moon. If you're looking at big objects, small objects, or still smaller objects, it's all cratered. And that is the evidence of the micrometeorites, that is, tiny meteorites that have hit. The Apollo astronauts brought back a good sample of rock, something like about 70 kilograms, or about 150 pounds of rocks. And when these are examined, what you find is they are all cratered. Not only that, but you will also, if you leave something on the moon for a while, what you will also find is it gets slightly pitted as a result of the micrometeorites that are coming in. So there's plenty of evidence that you have micrometeorite bombardment on the moon even to this day.
The lander itself,
but I forget which probe it was that the astronauts were able to cut a piece out of and bring back. Were the surveyor probes, right. The surveyor probes that preceded the Apollo probes, and that does show evidence of pitting that has occurred on the metal surface of the probe. It was very interesting because they cut off a cable and they brought it back, and not only do you have the evidence of the scouring that takes place from the micrometeorites, but interestingly enough, in the internal part of the cable, there were still some dormant life forms from Earth that were able to exist in spite of the very, very severe conditions that you find on the surface of the moon. Very interesting to see how tenacious life is.
Can you explain, quote, the rate of cosmic gust that the young Earth created to speak of?
Yes, I can explain that. In fact, I explained it in an article that came out in March of 1976 in the Journal of the ASA Society. Basically, the argument that has been used from the standpoint of cosmic dust to show that the Earth is young goes as follows. We know that both the Moon and the Earth is constantly being bombarded by meteorites, large and small. A lot of this material is very tiny that we call dust that comes into the Earth, falls through the atmosphere, and collects on Earth. And then this material is eventually washed into the oceans. There's something very interesting about cosmic dust, and that is it is richer in some metals than what you find dust on Earth, native to Earth being rich in. For example, cosmic dust is very rich in nickel. Cosmic dust is very rich in an element called iridium. Iridium, you have an enormous concentration of iridium in cosmic materials than what you have on Earth-based materials. Now, the argument goes as follows. There were some measurements that were taken of the rate of cosmic dust infall to the Earth back in the late 50s, early 60s. It was felt that most of the dust that fell into the Earth was rich in iridium and nickel, And if that is the case, given the cosmic rate that was thought to be, given the cosmic rate that people thought was in existence, this material, the addition of iridium and nickel on the surface of the Earth, and cobalt, by the way, which then would have been washed into the ocean, should have enriched the amount of nickel and cobalt and iridium in the ocean very drastically, very dramatically. However, when you look at the amount of those elements in ocean, not just in the water, dissolved in the water, but in the sediments, you find that there is not very much. And so the argument was as follows. Given the rate of inflow of this material, if it had been falling for 4.5 billion years, the washing of that material into the ocean should give us a very great amount of nickel and cobalt and iridium in the oceans. But in effect, you don't find that much. When you calculate how long the inflow rate would be operating to give you the amount of nickel and cobalt and iridium in the ocean, it was calculated to be only a few tens of thousands of years rather than a few billions of years. I looked at that argument, I found the following. First of all, the kind of material that falls to Earth is not the kind that is rich in nickel and cobalt. It turns out really it's the kind that is, there are various kinds of meteorites that fall to Earth and fall on the Moon. Some of them are rich in nickel, a good bit of it isn't. And the part that is rich in nickel is really a small fraction of the total that falls. Therefore, the amount of enrichment of ocean water over 4.5 billion years that you would have as a result of nickel and cobalt falling in from outer space really turns out to be only about 1% of the total amount of enrichment that you get just from erosion of Earth materials over 4.5 billion years. And with that, in my mind at least, it ended the discussion of feeling that the inflow rates of material to Earth is really going to enrich the amount of nickel, cobalt, and iridium that you're going to find in ocean waters. Interestingly enough, the Moon's surface, the dust on the Moon's surface, has also been examined for inflow rates. And it is felt that about 2% of the surface of the Moon is due to material falling into the Moon. 98% is a result of erosion of materials on the Moon. And this also gives us an idea of the kind of material that falls onto the Moon, the kind of material that falls onto the Earth. And again, when you look at the total addition of nickel and cobalt, you again come up with roughly about 1%, 2% at the most, of what is originally eroded from the surface of the Earth to begin with. And so that cannot be used as an argument for a young Earth. Let me just make a parenthetical remark here very briefly. Another argument that you will hear is that the Moon is young, the Earth is young, because if the Moon were as old as people feel it should be, there should be a huge dust layer on the Moon. And when the space probes landed on the Moon, especially the Apollo probes, they should have sunk down into the dust. When you look at pictures, however, you see that the probes only sunk into the Moon's surface a couple inches. Therefore, we don't have all this dust on the Moon. Therefore, the Moon must be young, not old. That's an argument that's presented. Here's the problem with that argument. First of all, let me present the following. Suppose you go out to the beach, and you're on dry sand, and you step on dry sand. How far in do you sink? Maybe an inch? Maybe an inch and a half? Does it mean there's only an inch and a half of sand there? No, there's a lot of sand there, but when you sink into it, the sand packs. And you don't sink all the way down to the bottom. And that's exactly the process that is happening on the Moon. There is a lot of dust there. There are feet of dust there. There are hundreds of feet of dust and rubble on the Moon. But the space probe, when it landed, compresses this material down to a depth of about an inch and a half, and the rest of the material holds up the space probe. So it's not that there isn't a lot of dust on the Moon. There is a lot of dust on the Moon, but it compresses. Yet it's not going to sink in. The space probe isn't going to sink in. There's another thing that happens on the surface of the Moon as well. The surface of the Moon has no atmosphere. Therefore, the particles on the surface of the Moon can weld together. And that doesn't happen so much on the Earth, because the Earth has an atmosphere, and tiny particles on the Earth's surface absorb air. And really, when you get two particles touching together on the surface of the Earth, it's not so much the particles that are touching together, but a layer of air that has been absorbed on the surface that's touching together, and hence particles on the surface of the Earth can remain loose. But on the surface of the Moon, particles aren't covered with a layer of air that has been absorbed onto the surface. Rather, particles can touch together, and when you get the same material touching together, it can weld together. And so the surface of the Moon is slightly welded together. The dust particles are slightly welded together to give you a crunchy crust, if you like. And so when the space probe lands, again, the long and short of it is that it is supported. And so the depressions that you find in the Moon due to the space probes do not show that there is little dust. There's a lot of dust, but it's compressed, and it holds up the space probe. That argument cannot be used for a young Earth or a young Moon.
I have a biological question, Dr. Bloom. Does a developing fetus have a tail? If so, why? Does it prove evolution?
What's the famous jargon phrase here? Something recapitulates. Ontology recapitulates biology.
I have a logic.
And we come back. This is, I have some overheads on this. I guess I won't bother with enough. This was one of the, I'm not sure if Darwin used it, but some of the people used it very quickly afterwards. If you look at embryonic development of animals, you see them go through a sequence, for example, where it seems like they have gill slits here in the neck. And they, for example, in humans, you see kind of a tail-like structure that develops at the back, which then shrinks away later. And the basic argument that was deduced was this, was that in the development of the fetus of, you know, just about anything, we were seeing evolution taking place from the simple to the complex. There was this, the fetus was going through the evolutionary stages of gills and tails and so on until it was finally born. That model was been attacked and pretty well shot down, I would say. The basic problem that the people who study embryos, embryology, have come across is the problem that some of these structures seem to be required for the development of the animal. And if it's a structure that's required for the fetus to develop, you can't say that that proves something about the evolution of the animal because the structure is there. So these probes in the neck and things like that could not be shown, the cells in these probes could not be shown to be related to any part of the circulatory system of the animal, for example, as it developed later, or any part of the lungs of the animal as it developed later. So basically it was a phenomenological thing. We saw these structures that looked primitive, but when you would study the cells, where they came from and what they later developed into in the embryo as it developed, it wasn't showing, these structures weren't related to anything that they looked like, the gills being the more famous symbol. So basically in embryology, they sort of backed off of this embryonic development showing you evolutionary processes and consider it kind of a dead idea. And there's plenty of secular guys who can really feel it better than I can in that regard.
Again, Dr. Bloom, if Adam was a special creation about Homo erectus, is Homo erectus a soul?
Depends whether or not Homo erectus was Adam. Yes, is the thing you have to say. Adam, not so much on the basis of God breathed into him a breath of life, because that word living soul in the King James is actually breath, which is used of other animals as well, can be used of other animals as well. But the idea that man is an eternal being, I would say, is part of God creating Adam especially. And then the question becomes, again, where do we place Adam in these humanoid fossils that we find? If we place Adam with anatomically modern human, then Homo erectus, which was before that, becomes, speculate anything you would want, the primate that died out, something like that.
If Homo erectus was Adam, who then developed into anatomically modern human over time, then Homo erectus had a soul. So I'm kind of putting it that way. I would link a soul with God's special creation of Adam, and which fellow we put that with, anatomically modern human and Homo erectus, I think is something we look in the fossil and try to analyze and reconcile up with a little bit of reason.
Either Dr. Moon or Dr. Dope might like this one. If God is God, does there have to be another, quote, Earth-like planet for there to be life, that is, life, but not necessarily as we know it?
Part of the problem is that trying to see exactly how life as we know it operates is a problem. It's complicated enough, and therefore to try to understand life as we don't know it becomes even more complicated. Theoretically, you may have living systems that are based on a totally different kind of chemistry than we have, but it is hard at this point to see how that goes. In this regard, I was talking to a biochemist a few years back who said to me that, as far as he was concerned, he himself could not see how life could exist in any other way than the biochemistry that we have operating on Earth today. That is, one that's based on carbon and the ability of carbon to form long chains of complicated molecules, a la what Dr. Newman was speaking of. And I personally feel that if life exists, that is the way it's going to exist. It may sound like carbon chauvinism, but when you look at the chemistry of things, it's hard for me to see life existing in any other way. So in answer to that question, of course, God could create life forms using different kinds of chemistry. Whether he has or not, I don't know, but I tend to feel that life is based on this kind of chemistry. And therefore, I would say for life to exist elsewhere in the galaxy or the universe, you need Earth-like planets for it to exist on.
Coming at it from a different direction. The Bible, I think, would indicate there is other kind of life in existence. Whether it's in the universe or not depends on some definition of universe. But the biblical picture, I think, regarding angels and that sort of thing suggests there's some other kind of life. But suggests probably that kind of life is not exactly what we call chemical or such. But just how to characterize it beyond that is pretty far to my depth. So we've got to quit.
An easier question, perhaps. Does an infinite universe contradict the concept of an infinite God?
No, I don't think so. I believe it's George Gamow in his popular work, 1, 2, 3, Infinity, discusses different kinds of infinities that mathematicians have worked out several different levels of infinities. The smallest level of infinity are what they call countable infinities, where you can take objects and they're like the countable numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's an infinity. And any infinity of objects that you can assign one of them to go with one, and there's another one to go with two, and another one to go with three, etc. And you have a rule by which you can assign one of the objects of this set to one of the numbers. That's a countable infinity, and that's what they call Aleph zero in the notation. But then there are other kinds that you can't assign to that, and I don't remember much about it now. It's been about 30 years since I read the book, but it seemed to me he said the number of kinds of curves that you can define is a higher order infinity. I don't remember whether that was Aleph 1 or whether that was up higher on the level. So we could certainly imagine that God is an infinity of a Aleph 20 or an Aleph infinity or something like that, and therefore could I suppose easily, I don't know how to talk about these things, create a smaller infinity of some sort. Okay. Now, I don't know that the Bible says anything in that regard. There are a couple of remarks that suggest to me that probably the universe is finite, like God calling all the stars by name. If you have an infinite universe of a very small number of the stars, they've got to have infinitely long names. And to call them by name, you've got to pronounce them infinitely fast to get through an infinite name in a finite time. Of course, God could probably do that. So how much that's figurative also, I do not know. So.
There's also a geometric example on higher order infinities. I can take a line and stretch it out to infinity. in both directions. But I can also take a plane in two dimensions. That would be one dimension. I can also take a plane in two dimensions and stretch it out into infinity. I can also take a sphere, three-dimensional object, and stretch it out to infinity. And there, too, you're also dealing with different kinds of infinities. So you might think of God as a three-dimensional infinity, and you're looking at a universe at a two- or one-dimensional infinity. It would be another way to look at it. We should mention, however, there's absolutely no evidence that the universe is infinite. It was thought to be the case earlier, but lately the evidence is very much, very, very heavily weighted towards a universe that is not infinite. So it's maybe that makes the whole discussion then going to be a moot point. But the evidence points to a universe that is finite.
Final two recorded questions. One is technical and genetics, and then finally a theological question. The technical question for Dr. Bloom. Please briefly define, content question, briefly define the following terms and the composition, number, and function of each. DNA, RNA, human gene, and the human genome. I'll hand you that one in writing.
Okay, vocabulary test time here.
Eraser.
I'll just...
Sleeve.
Yes. I'll start with the big one first. Genome, as I recall, subject to some error here, genome is the whole genetic information in the cell. So if you have your cell and your nucleus, this is a eukaryotic thing, you've got this, all your chromosomes and all that, making up all the genetic information of the cell. That's the genome. Now, human genes are subsections of this genome. If you were to take the human one and stretch it out and make it one piece, it'd be about six feet long. And on this 6 feet long piece, this is where the other term comes in, this genome is made up of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, which is a general term for the molecules that are making up this chain, that are the balls on the chain here of the genome. So the DNA is the monomers that make up the polymer of the genome. Now, in this genome are sections where there are some coding that tells your... Okay, before I get into that, back off one more and explain. Okay, this is the DNA in the genome. Now, this is in the nucleus, but the protein synthesis takes place out here in the ribosomes that are out in the cytoplasm of the cell. To get the information from the DNA to the ribosomes, the cell makes a copy, a Xerox copy in effect, on one gene, so that one of these sites that says if you want to metabolize this type of sugar, come here and copy off this information that you ship out to make the enzymes to metabolize that sugar. There can be several enzymes that are made that are through this one gene that is turned on to make these several pieces of RNA. I believe that's a reasonable summary of gene level of what's going on. So, I don't remember to draw out the exact molecular structures of the DNA and the RNA. That's fairly complicated. I've got some overhead to show that. But that's the general picture that's going on.
I'd like to preface the final theological question with a statement from a very wise philosopher who once said it's never wise to be asking questions about someone else's wife. Here's the question. Where did Cain and Abel get their wives?
The Bible says elsewhere further on that Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters, so presumably one of the other daughters would have been a wife for each of them. That, I think, is the simplest, that's the most economical explanation of the thing. Obviously, there have been people, even evangelical people, who have argued for pre-Adamic man and things like that, so I just don't think there's any point to wander off.
That statement, by the way, comes from the genealogies in chapter 5 of Genesis, verse 7. when it says about Adam, and after he became the father of Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and had other sons and daughters. Earlier, after Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. That's Genesis 5, verse 4. Now, later on, there's prohibition against marrying one's own sister. But that is after you have been around for a while, after the human race has been around for a while, and there are great dangers in marrying close relatives, because any genetic mishaps that has occurred to one member of the family can also have occurred to the other member of the family, and then the chances of that matching up and giving you even a greater mishap is greatly enhanced. Early part in the human race, however, that is not a problem. Human race has not been around long enough to have those kinds of mishaps. So marrying one's own sister at that particular time would not have been a problem. In fact, we would find later on that Abraham is marrying his half-sister back in, 2000 B.C.
I have a philosophy of religion class at my college, and we were talking about Aquinas' proofs and going with cosmological proof, the ontological proof. And I think I was the only one in the class who was a theist of any type. And I wasn't trying to debate or dialogue, but the question arose as to whether the universe was eternal or whether it wasn't. And I brought up the second law of thermodynamics. We got on, and I said, everything in the beginning. And she said, well, there's a new theory that black holes go around in a circular motion, and as one black hole, I don't know what she said, as one galaxy breaks down, it fuels the other black hole, and it creates another universe, and it all goes around in a circle, and so therefore you have an infinite loop. And I just sort of sat there with my jaw open, right?
I'd probably sit there with my jaw open too. Yeah. The idea is the following, that black holes are like the ultimate cosmic vacuum cleaner. Because of their very high gravity, they suck everything in that's around them within a certain range. And so everything goes into a black hole. But in the black hole, you have very funny things that happen to space and time. And so the idea is that there might be a counterpart of that in universe, or even another universe, so-called white hole, where everything's coming out. And some people feel that at one time they thought maybe quasars, where you have an enormous amount of energy being generated, that maybe that was a white hole. It turns out that that too appears to be a black hole. But really she's making a lot of assumptions on the structure of space and time to think that material can enter in to a black hole in one part of the universe and come out in another part of the universe or in another universe. There's just an incredible amount of assumptions that are made, and if she is depending upon that to bail her out of a universe that is finite or a universe that has not been around for an infinite amount of time, she's got problems.
She said something too about circular pattern of light. I wasn't sure how she threw that in. Does that make any sense at all?
No.
Marvel somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe between her reading and her presentation.
Yeah. If you have a finite universe, conceivably light that takes off in one direction can go around, kind of come back to its origin after billions of years. But there you have a finite universe that has been around for a finite amount of time. You don't have an infinite universe.
Well, in deducing your science from Star Trek.
Star Trek features, yeah.
Star Trek, yes.
John, did you say that a chromosome is 6 feet long?
Oh.
Or a gene, or
the whole DNA. Yeah, and then there's 24. That occurs in about 24 pairs of pieces or something like that in the human. So if you pasted them all together, you'd get the 6 foot long.
I read a book on chaos studies, and I was surprised to say that the next direction that will be taken in biology is to understand how form of animals, ferns and everything else comes about. Have you come across any material along these lines?
I have not read the book on chaos. I've heard the title several times. I think I've got it on order finally, so I'll have to read that to see where that's going. It sounds like you're discussing maybe fractals or something like that.
Fractal patterns in the fern leaf or some fern leaves here.
Yeah.
But,
in which you have a pattern reproduced on several different levels of structure. And it's clear that those kind of things reproduce things that look like Earth's terrain, living plants, et cetera, things like that. So the suspicion is that perhaps some studies in that area might help something on watering and the way the plant goes about doing things and such. I don't think that's going to generate a way of getting around the problem of going from very little order, say, in a typical inorganic molecule up to the kind of level of order we've got in a cell or something like that. We're going from a few lines to millions of pages of information.
I think, though, that it may demonstrate the consistency of form of how God created things to bear after their own kind. And as a result of that, I think it may really fit into the creationist camp to say things that aren't going willy-nilly, and we're understanding better how these forms come about. I raise a question on the teeth and the horns because I have trouble, I haven't researched the information enough, but I have trouble believing that that really might be microevolution. That's just where I'm at.
Yeah. There's some interesting things in genetic structure. I don't know whether any of us listed in any of our bibliographies or not, but the Great Evolution Mystery by Rattray Taylor has some rather interesting remarks on unexpressed genes and that sort of thing. He points out that some rather strange things happen in some living things, like some of your insects that go from a larval to an adult stage. You kind of get a brief period in there where everything is getting reorganized inside the animal, and then it comes out with a different organization and moves off. And obviously you've got some kind of information inside for the organization of it as a caterpillar, and then a different set for the organization of it as an adult, and some kind of instructions to turn off the one and turn on the other. And so his idea was to try to solve some of these problems we've been looking at regarding evolution, that some things are turned on, you know, turn on wings or something like that. And the big question that raised for me was, why would there be any working plans for wings inside something that you could turn on unless you had a designer there? It's very hard to see how to get that out of mutation and natural selection, unless there was some time for that to have operated back earlier to put all this information in.
Before today, creation, as God created the sun, the word create, I assume that we interpret that to be made to appear. Secondly, is the idea of a vapor canopy around Earth, is that pretty well universally accepted by secular scientists, and also the notion that I think is implied that the Earth was covered with liquid water at one particular time. Is that fairly well universally accepted? And then the last one, one of the pictures you said about granitic rock up above as opposed to basaltic that we can see. Granitic really the best choice there? Is it granitic rock is really underground rock, or is that being used in a larger sense?
I think that's being used in a larger sense. I think that's sialic and somatic rock. I'll have the wrong one with the wrong group if I don't watch it, so I won't tell you which I think it is. But I think that's all that's going on there. I think if you're just looking at the term made all through the section there on the lights and the skies.
About what that word means in Hebrew. I got some scientists and Hebrew people up here. I just want to
respond. Yeah. I think we're not even working with the word create here in that passage.
Yeah, I don't know if it's bara or asah that is used there.
I thought it was asah, but I'm not sure. I don't have a Hebrew Bible in front of me. And the NIV just says made all the way through, rather than created at this point. Whereas I think he said they use the word create here in some other places. He created him. I think the NIV is sticking pretty carefully with made for Asa and create for Bara, in which case we don't get any create in that particular passage. The question of the whether the earth was ever totally covered by water, I am not sure how things stand in secular geology.
But that's a reasonable.
It appears to be a reasonable suggestion.
No,
I don't think there's a big problem in that direction. Largely, your problem, I think, is that the further you go back, the less stuff you've got that you're sure was across, further you get back, you just got these sort of little, these shields and stuff, and what they were doing, I'm not sure. Maybe someone else has got better information on that.
Water is volatile, that is to say, it evaporates very easily, etc. So driving it out of the interior of the Earth, early in the history of the Earth, and letting it being also a light substance, not a dense substance, it's going to come up to the surface very easily. Now, above that, you may get some large volcanoes, some large shield volcanoes like Mauna Loa or something like that, that would poke up above. But to get continents, you get a lot of continents or substantial areas of continents, then you need a separation that takes place in the rock itself from the basalt, the granitic, and the floating idea that Bob was talking about here. So in the early Earth, it may be that you get some volcanoes that are poking up over through the water, but the idea of continents would be a later appearance on the Earth rather than an early appearance of the Earth. So for all practical purposes, the early Earth would be covered with water.
The dry ground is really referring to continents.
The land, I have sizable continents there, yes. Also, you mentioned something about the water canopy.
Yeah.
The vapor canopy, yes. I thought maybe you were referring to the idea that some Christians have that the waters above the heavens is a water canopy of liquid water.
No, what preceded vapor.
Okay, gotcha.
That
gotcha. From a scientific or from a biblical? From science, yes. Yes.
The Bible talks about Christ sitting on the right hand of the Father and Andrew's worshiping, looking at how he did the consolation. Where is that?
Sounds like the question, where is heaven?
Where is heaven, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. I have a whole talk on that. I give up presentations, which is about 15% biblical material and about 85% speculation. Biblical material regarding heaven suggests that although up is used with it rather frequently, it's also around us in some sense, so that God could be pictured as speaking from heaven even though his voice was coming from the cloud on Mount Sinai and that sort of thing. And I discuss the various passages in that direction and suggest that that the best model I can think of at the moment is to think of heaven as in some fourth spatial dimension around us, all directions in some sense, some invisible sort of thing. And that's kind of where I'd leave it. If you're really interested, there's a cassette tape in that little catalog on Where's Heaven? So give you a better discussion of that. Perry looked at that, our first session, if you didn't get a chance to get here.
Yes, personally, I feel that the day is figurative, and the reasons I go to a figurative interpretation are the language, the word day, morning, and evening, is used figuratively, especially the word day is used figuratively elsewhere in Scripture. Morning and evening are used figuratively elsewhere in Scripture. But also, when you look at the events of the sixth day that you see in Genesis chapter 2, I find too many things occurring to fit them all into a 24-hour period. That's the first thing we can say. Second, the language that is used in Genesis chapter 2, the idea of God planting a garden, not creating it, but planting it, causing trees to grow, Adam naming the animals, Adam not being able to find among the animals a helper that is suitable for himself. And then the phrase that is used when he meets Eve, when seen elsewhere in Scripture, is a phrase that is used when there's been a period of time where things are not going well, and then finally things are working out. Tying all of that together, you can make a very good scriptural argument that day six was longer than 24 hours. And if day six is longer than 24 hours, there's no reason then to insist that the other 5 days have to be 24-hour days. And so I come out on the side of feeling that days are used figuratively in Genesis chapter 1, and the figure is unspecified length, but with a beginning and an end. Evening ends, morning begins. But that is argued among Christians. Interestingly enough here, Bob believes the days are literal, but they separate big periods of time, long periods of time. I mean, there are many, many variations on this.
Two questions. When were the angels created on this 7-day program? The second question is, are secular scientists feeding all this information like mutations and gene activations in the computer to find out if they have a yes or no answer, whether or not evolution is plausible?
I'll try to refer from there. Hit me with the wording again.
Well, when were angels created at the beginning of the universe?
There's been a lot of speculation about that, and you'll see in some of your early Jewish and Christian commentaries various suggestions whether it created the first day or things of that sort. The thing I think has been helpful to me is clearly the creation account mentions them nowhere. Okay. And over in the book of Hebrews, you have a reference to the heavenly tabernacle as not being of this creation. And since reason to believe that the heavenly tabernacle must be a creation, presumably it's not something that's always existed, then it implies there was some other creation. And so the simple understanding then would be that the angels are this other creation. If you want to try and speculate a great deal, you could suggest that perhaps we live in a four-dimensional space or something of that sort, which was created, the angels created in connection with it, and then we live in a three-dimensional subspace of some sort that was created in the Genesis account with man in it, etc. And that's what we're told about because that's the only universe we can see. But we're climbing on some awkward thin things by the time we get far. What I would say is I think the Bible would warrant us to believe that although the angels, etc. are created, they are apparently do not belong to this creation. There's something perceived.
Usually some about the computer programs for simulating evolution.
Evolution, yeah.
The work you did with Langdon's model.
There have been a number of attempts to try and simulate evolution on computer. A big discussion of that took place at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia some years ago, must have been 15 years ago now or more, maybe late 60s, in which the mathematicians kept running up against the problem that they couldn't simulate evolution on computers. They kept getting garbage. Instead of getting improved complexity, you know, growing complexity that made sense, that sort of thing. And basically, many of them concluded that the Darwinian model mutation natural selection did not produce the results desirable. I had a chance just a year or two ago. I was interested in this thing I did mention a night or two ago, last night, I guess, this morning would have been, this idea of Paley's that watch is some sort of a design, if you like, but a living thing is more than like a watch. It's like a watch. You can make a copy of itself. A watch, you can make a watch. And so I've been on the lookout for several years for information regarding self-reproducing automatons, a machine that will make a copy of itself. Not like a Xerox, where you can draw a picture of a Xerox on a sheet of paper and put it on top of the Xerox machine, and you get a copy of the Xerox picture, but like a Xerox machine that you can turn it on and plunk out the other end with coming out of a Xerox machine. And some work has been done on that. It's mostly in the form of mathematics, of imagining that you've got an infinite plane of computer chips all hooked together and asking, can you specify some finite number of these computer chips in such a way that they will tell each other to do certain things and begin to turn on some computer chips over here so that when they're finished, this array is like this array. And this array over here, and then we'll now make another set of them out there further, and that will make another set that will be turning on these computer chips so that they'll run like a little computer and make their whole job will be to make another, to turn on another little thing over here that will be a new computer. And that's programmable. And this fellow named Stephen Langton designed a program to show how to make something simple like that. And I messed around and figured out how to program that into my little computer, K-Pro, and got it to work. Such. But then what I was interested in was how complicated is it? And so I tried to do some calculations. And although it doesn't look complicated at first, it turns out that the chance of something like that arising, given that you've already got this, all the set of chips put together, given that by some random process the organization would happen to turn on the right set of them to make another copy, etc., it turns out that that there's virtually no chance of that in the universe. I think it was turned out there was one chance in 10 to the 120 something in the history of the universe that you'd get anything happen like that. I worked that out in a paper over there. It's not one that was in the handout group, but it's one over here, one of the blue jaws over here. Self-reproducing automata and the origin of life. Well, that's an attempt to get a computer simulation and figure out what the complexity is there.
Jim, I have a question directed towards Dr. Phillips. Last year, I came specifically only to the question and answer series. And I was very intrigued. You were talking with somebody about the flood. And I was intrigued with your response. And I wanted to know what your feelings are about the flood. I think, if I remember correctly, you thought it was just in a specific area. And I'd also like to know a little bit about the extinction of dinosaurs, and maybe a comment from Dr. Newman and Dr. Bloom on some of
that. Okay, as far as the flood, big discussion here is whether the flood was universal in the sense that it covered the whole Earth or whether it covered part of the Earth. I'm content with the idea that the flood at least covered the extent of human beings and domestic animals. I tend to feel that the animals that were brought on the ark are primarily those as domestic animals that would have a rough time in the wilds, and perhaps some of the wild animals as well in the location that would be around where humanity existed before the flood. And the ark then saves Noah and his family, saves at least some of the animals, some of the kinds of the animals that you have in that location, and then the flood comes, wipes out humanity, certainly wipes out humanity, but at least Noah and his family are able to survive and, along with some of the domesticated animals, etc. I'm happy with that view. I don't think the terminology that you find in Genesis, basically chapters 7 through 9, necessarily point to a flood that covered every last mountaintop on Earth. On the other hand, I can live with that. I can live with that. Again, here in my attempt to tie together science and scripture, to tie together the special revelation with the general revelation, I have a hard time seeing the separation of different kinds of animals on Earth today. For example, marsupials in Australia, New Zealand, etc., from other kinds of mammals. Separation of animal forms between the New World and the Old World. I have a hard time seeing that separation if all of those animals were on the ark, and then after the flood water subsided, have those animals spread out and cover the earth. I have a hard time understanding how some of those divisions could take place. I don't have a hard time understanding that over the course of long periods of time, how those divisions could take place. So again, I'm very honest. I'm very open in saying that. Now, part of my interpretation of the flood really comes from what I think is valid science, but then when I look at the terminology in Genesis, I don't feel that it insists a universal flood. Okay, so that's basically where I am at that point. I must say that sometimes how I feel about whether I have a universal flood or a local flood kind of depends on what mood I'm in when I get up that day, but I'm tending more and more towards a local flood. But it's certainly something that I need to consider and look at periodically to see what is happening there. Now the second part of your question. Dinosaurs. I have no problem with dinosaurs existing up until about 65 some odd million years ago, around way before human beings came. And the end of the dinosaurs, a lot of theories that have been proposed. The one that kind of gained a lot of favor, then fell out of favor, but now is beginning to gain favor again as more and more evidence comes in, is that you had a huge collision between the Earth and a extraterrestrial body that raised a lot of dust on Earth, that cut down sunlight, that cooled off the Earth, destroyed a lot of plants, both because of the lack of sunlight and also because of fires that would have been generated as a result of the impact. That process being the reason for the end of the dinosaurs, the so-called impact theory. Catastrophic, by the way, interestingly enough, a catastrophic theory for the end of the dinosaurs. The theory proposed by Luis Alvarez and his son. There you have a situation where it appears that you have a cataclysmic end to the dinosaurs of 65 million years before humans appeared on the scene. I have no problem with that.
I've heard certain people say that the dinosaurs were brought into the ark, but they were baby dinosaurs.
Yeah. Well, if you do not accept the ages of the Earth, then you have a problem trying to correlate where all the animal life was and how it was brought on the ark. I have difficulty with that. Yeah, to me, I have no problem with the age of the Earth. I have no problem with dinosaurs existing 65 million years before human beings came on.
And they were extinct well
before. And they were extinct well before the flood.
You had a point last time also about the species of beetles, if I remember, tied in with this, and how there were a lot more species of beetles. At that time, you couldn't have got them all in the ark or something like that. We have too many species now.
Yeah, I don't know if I had mentioned that, but I think I know what you're getting at. Interestingly enough, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that there are more different kinds of beetles on the Earth than anything else. That's the greatest number of species really occurs in the beetle family.
Certainly in the insect family.
Yeah, certainly in the insect family, and in the insect family, the beetle family is the largest. Yeah, when you start to calculate how, if you really are bringing two of each kind of every species and you're going to include insects as well as the animals, although insects are not mentioned, again, I feel I mentioned are the mammals primarily and birds, etc. You try to bring two of each kind into an ark, even as large as the ark is, you're going to have a very difficult time bringing two of everything in. Maybe whoever was mentioning that was referring to that. I don't recall my mentioning it. But I may have. I don't remember what I said yesterday, let alone what I said a year ago. comments to that?
A comment is that I don't necessarily think that any particular passage we want to talk because we have definitely here, the line in Alaska, where the conditions are extremely hot.
Yes.
And under some very hot conditions, where they go to the and they hang on from there. In the form of eggs or something, and if you want meat, we can stay there for a
absolutely
long
right.
time.
Right.
And when the conditions are right, we'll
eat that. Right,
right. Let's take Tom's question and then we'll turn it back over to Mike. And if you have another question, you can see him afterwards. Go ahead, Tom.
Just a comment, very short comment about the flood. Meteorologically speaking, in order to have bad weather, you have to have good weather. It's very simply meaning that, of course, low pressure centers form, well, high pressure, actually, it's due to high pressure, which means high pressure is found in the center of air masses. So that, really, in order to have a storm, and by any meteorological sense, you have to have good weather somewhere else. You could have rain for a long period of time in one spot, but if it's going to meet any model that we have, meteorologically speaking, you have to have high pressure centers somewhere else.
And the thing, to get a lot of destruction, you don't need every last mountain covered. I think some of the flooding that occurred with Hurricane Agnes back in 72, was it? Some areas that were isolated. All you need is communication routes broken for animals and for humans, and you'd have great difficulty. So somebody might say, well, if the flood wasn't up above the highest mountains, then why couldn't the people and the animals just run up to the highest places? Fine, where are you going to find food? Where are you going to find shelter? Where are you going to find protection that is necessary? You're going to have a lot of competition in those high areas, and after a while, you're going to get wiped out anyway from exposure. So the idea that if the flood isn't universal, things really could escape, I don't buy. Not in the location where you have the water. As you say, in other locations, animals survive. Certainly fish survive. Plants can survive in various ways. Plants also can survive waters by going into some kind of a dormancy, or at least you have seeds that are carried along and then later buried, etc. Is there a question over here?
Yeah, sorry, this may not be related to this, but I think it's completely dormant. I think that
I don't see, I guess a lot of it depends on what you think God can do and not do. As one person pointed out, as human beings, we can take metal and piece it together that will hold a number of human beings alive underwater for months. Certainly the God of the universe ought to be able to appoint a fish to keep one human alive for 3 days. So I think part of that depends on whether, how big our God is, and whether we are going to accept the miraculous or not. It's a miraculous story, but the means by which Jonah is kept from drowning, by the way, is to be swallowed by a fish and then vomited up on earth. The other thing you have to realize is that Jesus himself uses that as a model for his death, burial, and resurrection. And it's hard to see how Jesus would put that much emphasis on Jonah's being in the belly of a fish, of a great fish, when it really is not, is something that didn't happen. In other words, it's hard for me to see how Jesus would refer to that when in effect it's just an allegory or just a story, because Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection is a literal death, burial, and resurrection. And he sees a model of that in what happened to Jonah. So I see Jonah as occurring literally as well. We have to be careful not to eliminate a story like Jonah just because we may have some prejudice against the supernatural.